Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 26 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at our home planet. The Council of Parties to the Paris Climate Accord have held their meeting in Glasgow. Many heads of state and hundreds of bureaucrats rocked up to give speeches and to negotiate future actions and commitments. One section was devoted to the issue of atmospheric methane, which is a major greenhouse gas. The global methane pledge was taken by many countries to reduce methane emissions. First to pledge were Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, and Joe Biden, the President of the United States of America. Here's what they had to say.
All of you are leading on this, and I'm delighted to introduce to you President von der Leyen of the European Commission and the President of the United States, my boss, Joe Biden.
What a pleasure to be here with you, Excellencies, distinguished guests, my fellow leaders, ladies and gentlemen. When we talk about climate action, we look at two different horizons. There's one, of course, of climate neutrality by mid-century, but there's a second one, and that's the closer one. And this is much more urgent, and this is the horizon of 2030. We have to act now. We need big structural changes, yes, to reach 2050 climate neutrality, but we cannot wait for 2050. We have to cut emissions fast. And methane is one of the gases we can cut fastest. Doing that will immediately slow down climate change, because we all know methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. Roughly 30% of global warming since the Industrial Revolution is due to methane emissions. Methane is 80 times more global warming than CO2. And today, global methane emissions grow faster than at any time in the past. So cutting back on methane emissions is one of the most effective things we can do to reduce near-term global warming and keep 1.5 degrees Celsius. It is the lowest hanging fruit. On September 17th, when you, President Biden, dear Joe, hosted us for the Major Economies Forum, the European Union and the United States announced the Global Methane Pledge. Since then, our climate envoys, John Kerry and Frans Timmermans, have worked intensively, tirelessly, to gather support. And today, just over 6 weeks later, we are officially launching our methane pledge. And we're proud and happy and grateful that over 80 countries have signed up. This is fantastic. Thanks to you. Together, these over 80 countries commit to reduce global methane emissions by at least 30% by 2030 from 2020 levels on. Methane emissions come from various sources. We all know oil, gas, coal, agriculture, and landfillings. These sectors have different potential for short-term action. The greatest potential for cuts is, without any doubt, in the energy sector. And this is why next month, us, the European Commission, we will propose to regulate methane emissions. We will introduce rules to measure, to report, to verify methane emissions, rules to put limits on venting and flaring, and rules to detect leaks and repair them. And of course, our common agriculture policy is also increasing its focus on tackling methane emissions. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, fellow leaders, the Global Methane Pledge makes cutting on methane emissions a collective undertaking. This must, of course, be supported by a sound scientific basis and a capacity to monitor and to calculate methane emissions, because we all know that only what gets measured gets done. So that's why the European Commission supports the setup of an independent international methane emissions observatory through the UN Environment Programme. But we also all know that as important as this pledge is, it is about more than hitting targets. There are clear benefits to cutting emissions, methane emissions, yes, for the planet, but also so much for the people too. Because if we deliver on this pledge, we can prevent over 200,000 premature deaths. We can prevent hundreds of thousands of asthma-related emergency room visits and over 20 million tons of crop losses a year by reducing ground-level ozone pollution. I want to thank all those countries that have signed up to the Global Methane Pledge. With this global pledge, we are making COP26 the moment when the world moves from aspiration to action. And now it's my pleasure and honor to leave this podium for you, Mr. President Dirceu. Thank you.
It was very easy to follow Ursula, because she says it all well the first time. Look, I'm going to be very, very brief. I want to thank Ursula. Thank you so much to everyone here today, you know, for signing this game-changing commitment. One of the most important things we can do, and I keep referring, as many of you do, to this decisive decade, we've got to figure what we're going to do. It's not just between now and 2050. What we're going to do between now and 2030 is going to impact significantly on what whether we'll be able to meet our longer-term commitment. And one of the most important things we can do in this decisive decade is to keep 1.5 degrees in reach, is reduce our methane emissions as quickly as possible. As has already been stated, it's one of the most potent greenhouse gases there is. It amounts to about half the warming we're experiencing today, just the methane exposure. So together, we're committing to collectively reduce our methane by 30% by 2030. And I think we could probably go beyond that. We just announced this package at the General Assembly and back in September. At the time, as mentioned, 9 countries had signed on. Today, it's over 80. It's approaching 100 countries that are signing on. That's nearly half the global methane emissions, or 70% of the global GDP. And it's not it's going to make a huge difference. And not just when it comes to fighting climate change, as Ursula pointed out, the physical health of individuals and a whole range of other things. It's going to improve health, reduce asthma, respiratory-related emergencies. It's going to improve the food supply as well by cutting crop losses and related ground-level pollution. And it's going to boost our economies, saving companies money, reducing methane leaks, capturing methane to turn it into new revenue streams, as well as creating good-paying union jobs for our workers. And we're talking about jobs to manufacture new technologies for methane detection, jobs for union pipe fitters and welders to go out and cap abandoned oil wells and plug leaking pipelines, which there's thousands of miles of those. And it has been a foundational commitment of my administration from the beginning. It's something that I campaigned on, and today I'm announcing the next steps to reduce U.S. methane emissions. We're proposing 2 new rules, one through our Environmental Protection Agency that's going to reduce methane losses from new and existing oil and gas pipelines, and one through the Department of Transportation to reduce wasteful and potential dangerous leaks from natural gas pipelines. They have authority over that area. We're also launching a new initiative to work with our farmers and our ranchers to introduce climate-smart agricultural practices and reduce methane on farms, which is a significant source as well. And this is all part of our new methane strategy, which focuses on reducing the largest source of methane emissions while putting thousands of skilled workers on the job,
all across the United States, and I expect in your countries as well. So let me close again by reiterating, this isn't just something we have to do to protect the environment and our future. It's an enormous opportunity for all of us, all of our nations, to create jobs and make meeting climate goals a core part of our global economic recovery as well. The United States is eager to work with each of you to make sure we meet this goal and encourage more countries to join us in committing to reducing methane globally, because there are more that can join and should. So I want to thank you again. Much more to say, but much of it's already been said. But thank you for your partnership. Thank you for your ambition.
The Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Cole Morrison, did attend Glasgow and even made a speech that no one, well, at best few, took any notice of. Apparently, he spruiked the plan, which Paul Barry of ABC TV poked fun at.
Hi, I'm Paul Barry. Welcome to Media Bites. And let's go straight to that zero plan.
Our plan for net zero by 2050 is the plan that I believe Australians want.
Yes, that's what I call a plan. So let's have a bit of plan-splaining.
Our plan, right plan, our plan for net zero, the same plan and our plan, a careful plan, our plan, most importantly.
Yes, it was a fine performance by the PM, punching out that P word more than 70 times, then offering up 17 more plans on Sky that night, and another 7 on Sunrise next morning.
That's not our plan. That's not the Australian way. And our plan, which is the Australian way, our plan to get to net zero by 2050, gets that balance right.
But many on the left and the right were not buying the plan or the Australian way. With Carl on Today asking...
It's more a prayer than a policy, isn't it?
While The Guardian's Catherine Murphy said, this isn't a plan, this is status quo, with speculative graphs. And tech billionaire Mike Cannon-Brookes labelled it ridiculously embarrassing, inaction. Meanwhile, on Sky After Dark, Peter Credlin was also being mean, calling it lipstick on a pig, while colleague Andrew Bolt was likening it to Norman Lindsay's famous book.
The Magic Pudding. You could eat all you like of that pudding and... magic. It never got any smaller.
And what about the recipe for the pudding? Modelling for the plan.
And the detail of the modelling will be released at an appropriate time.
When?
But the outcomes...
No, it's a serious question and it's a serious policy. When is the appropriate time?
Steady on, Michael. You've got to get with the plan first.
Today and yesterday is about laying out the plan and explaining the plan to Australians. There's a lot of detail in the plan.
Right. Otherwise it's... wouldn't be a plan, would it?
But Scott Cole Morrison was nowhere to be seen or heard at the methane pledge event. Apparently, the plan does not cover methane. Well, at the pledge event, Gina McCarthy, the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C., set out what the United States is doing to put the methane pledge into effect.
In fact, today, the U.S. has committed to be a leader in this global methane challenge with the release of a whole-of-government methane reduction action plan. So you can see the actions that we plan to take and are already taking moving forward. In that plan, the EPA has already released proposed rules addressing oil and gas methane emissions as part of a bold, ambitious plan. And it will not only put us on track to deliver the global methane pledge, but it will create thousands of high-quality methane jobs. It will create thousands of jobs in our industries. It will spur innovation and new technologies that can be deployed globally, and it will address the public health impacts that we all know come along with methane emissions. Our plan is focused on the largest sources of methane emissions, where we can leverage every tool we have available to us to make sure that we accelerate cost-effective emission reductions in everything from our oil and gas sector to landfills to agriculture to our coal mines. This rule will make it easier to move forward together to limit methane emissions from new oil and gas sources, and we are setting the first ever standards for new oil and gas sources in our country. And it is the first standard to also address existing sources. But that's not only the beginning. Our Department of Transportation is upgrading and expanding key pipeline regulations to stop any leaks in millions of miles of gas pipelines in our country. And the Department of the Interior is addressing venting and flaring of methane from oil and gas operations and well closures on public lands and waters. The Department of Agriculture has already initiated and provided new incentives to reward farmers and ranchers for reducing their methane emissions. And EPA is ramping up its initiatives to reduce methane at landfills, building on regulations that they issued earlier this year. And President Biden's Build Back Better plan includes billions of dollars to create high-quality skilled jobs all across the country, employing dislocated workers to actually help reduce methane emissions from abandoned coal mines and plug orphan oil and gas wells where they have the skills and the ingenuity to get the job done well. And in the U.S., we're just getting started. So we're excited to be here. We look forward to working with all of you to achieve our collective goals while promoting the economic health and resilience of all of our countries. Thank you very much.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is Planet Earth.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Right, space show, back to Glasgow. Now, outside the main conference hall, a group of satellite operators were hosting a media event.
Hello and welcome back to the Methane Pavilion. I'm Kaylee Kreider and it's my honour to moderate the Space Race to Save the Planet. We're hosting this panel at an extraordinary time when countries, governments, businesses all see the demand for monitoring, review, and verification just surging. Traditional measurement of methane emissions really hasn't taken place at the scale, scope, or frequency that's needed to monitor methanes at near real time. There's an urgent need to be tracking and reporting emissions, not just at the global scale, but at regional, country level, and even at the corporate level. There's now a new generation of satellites and data platforms that have emerged with extraordinary accuracy. Now these new sets of data can be used by governments, the United Nations, investors, scientists, and civil society to see and compare methane emissions and performance. With regard to transparency, it's been said that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Each of the satellites and platforms that you're going to hear about today have different capacities, capabilities, insights. Some are public, some are private. And so I'm here to introduce to you today four experts who have an extraordinary background and experience. So I'd like to introduce them to you today. First of all is Dr. Steve Hamburg. I've had the joy of getting to know him just over the past year. He's the co-lead for MethaneSat, chief scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund, and chair of science oversight for the Committee for the International Methane Emissions Observatory, or IMEO. He's also organized a groundbreaking five-year series of 16 peer-reviewed studies documenting methane emissions at each step of the U.S. oil and gas supply chain, which found that methane emissions were at least 60% higher than official inventories. To his left, Riley Durham, CEO of the nonprofit Carbon Mapper, and research scientist at the University of Arizona and an engineering fellow at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which I had a chance to meet with my former boss, Al Gore, just an extraordinary institution. Next to him, Stéphane Germain, president of GHGSat, a company that pioneered orbital monitoring of greenhouse gases and is developing a constellation of methane-detecting satellites. And last but not least, Antoine Rostand, president and founder of Kairos, a data analytics company providing insight and analysis of climate and energy information from satellites and other sources. So welcome to all of you gentlemen. So happy to have you here. I was so excited to work on this panel. I had the chance to work on a satellite launch as well called Triana Discover. So I have a background in satellites myself. Took a little bit longer than we had hoped to get that one up, but it's up and running now. Three of you are involved in satellite mission. Kairos is a data analytics firm using data both from European Space Agency, Tropomi satellite, and other sources. I would love for each of you to take about 5 minutes and just talk about what you're doing and how you're doing it. And then I think we'll dive into how these puzzle pieces all fit together. But I'd just love for you all to kind of give an overview of what it is that you're doing that just can't come across in Q&A. So I'm going to start with you, Steve, and we're going to work our way down the line. All right?
Great. Thanks so much, Kaylee. So methane is an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas, as we've been hearing, and it's really exciting to hear that here at the COP, that it's really made the main stage, both literally and figuratively. So we designed MethaneSat to try and provide the information necessary to quantify all of the methane emissions from the oil and gas industry. We started by determining how much was being emitted and what the pattern of emissions were, and then work backwards for what kind of instrument we needed to be able to measure that from space. Working with Steve Wusty at Harvard, we developed that, and then we went to the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory and said, can you build an instrument with that level of precision? Because this was required greater precision than any satellite that was currently flying or even planned. So that's what's under construction now. It will have the highest level of precision of any greenhouse gas emissions measuring satellite currently flying or planned at about 3 parts per billion. And what it'll be able to do is map all of the methane emissions essentially. I mean, there is a detection threshold, but it's very low, about 5 kilograms per hour per square kilometer. So those of you who look at this, that's a darn low number. And we'll do that across all of the major oil and gas basins globally. And we will provide that data in policy-relevant form in that it will include the analysis of doing the full inversion, how we convert the concentration data that the satellite is able to collect to emissions flux rates, how much is being emitted where. And that the satellite project involved 2 major developments. One was this very high-precision instrument. The second was automating inversions, which no one had done before, so that all the data will flow through this satellite, this data platform, giving us an inversion data product, and that will be for both the area emissions, a heat map, as well as for the large emitting sources, things that have roughly 500 kilograms, per hour on the map. So we will be able to see the total and how it changes over time, as well as the large emitting sources. And as you'll hear from the next 2 speakers, that's complementary to the target mode instruments that can fill in more of the point sources, because they'll be able to see more of those point sources against our background of the total emissions. Now, we'll see those emissions. We won't know where they're happening. We can put those data together. So we create something we currently don't have. And Antoine will talk about Tropomi, which does similarly, can get the total, but its detection threshold is very high, which doesn't allow us to get the granularity. So we'll have data from pixels of 100 by 400 meters. Again, folks to my left will have much smaller pixels in the target mode. And it's really the basis of a complementary ecosystem of satellites. And we believe that this approach is critical to getting the data, as I said, to ensure the transparency. All the data will be public. All the L4, that emissions data, will be free of charge. It'll take us a little while to make it really quick, but we expect to be able to release it in just a few days to a week after it's collected. We'll do the full QAQC, the quality assurance, to have that out. So it'll come out quickly. It will be available. We'll be integrating it over time, looking for the trends that are occurring across these different geographies. And that combination, we're partnering with the New Zealand government, and they are going to use methane sat data with a research effort that they've started to look at agricultural emissions across the globe. We won't be able to map everywhere. While it is a mapper, it's still target mode. So we won't have the full coverage that Tripomi has, but we will be able to cover for the first time significant agricultural emissions with sufficient precision that we'll be able to quantify that. So, and they are going to run the Mission Operations Center in New Zealand, so they'll be the home of the operations, and we'll be constantly updating the targeting as we learn things, whether it's from other satellites and vice versa. We'll be sharing data to ensure that there's cooperation and the synergy among these satellites is maximized.
And it is, just in summary, it is interesting that Environmental Defense Fund, as far as I know, is the first nonprofit to ever be involved in launching a satellite.
I believe it is, and I forgot to mention the timeline. So we expect to be ready for launch in just about a year is the beginning of our launch window. We don't have a specific date. We are being launched. SpaceX is our launch provider, and we'll be working as we get closer to specifically. And as those of you who follow the satellite community, just like many right now, there are COVID delays across the industry. So there's a lot of dynamic relative to when both they'll be ready with their launch and the delays in the system, because it's a ride share. They got to put middle together. But certainly we will be ready, and we are very optimistic we'll be in our launch window.
Well, Raleigh, we'd love to hear more about Carbon Mapper.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, I'd like to just start and reflect on where we are. I think it's extremely exciting. My group at NASA started working on greenhouse gas monitoring across different scales over a decade ago. Back in the day, we were focused on monitoring emissions at the level of nation states. Can we provide independent checks on national inventories? And then we began to zoom in. We began to focus on states and then cities, and now individual facilities and pieces of equipment. And if you'd told me 10 years ago that I'd be sitting up here with three other organizations that are all building what is effectively a system of systems that will do a lot of that, you could have knocked me over with a feather. There was a great story in the New York Times just recently about the Orbiting Carbon Observatory observing a trend in CO2 emissions. We worked on that satellite for years. It's taken us almost a decade to get to this point. So this is becoming real. It is real, and it's super exciting to be here. And I just want to take a second and say, yay, us. Carbon Mapper is both the name of a new nonprofit that we established about a year ago and the public-private partnership we're incubating to deploy an operational system for monitoring CO2 and methane high-emitting point sources. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, a lot here in a minute, over a big chunk of the planet. And to do it very rapidly, because many of these sources are highly dynamic. They don't just emit at the same rate all the time. They're going on and off. They're variable. And so we're talking about providing daily monitoring of these sources on a regular basis. And as Steve says, to make that data publicly available for free as fast as we can reasonably do it. We have a public-private partnership that includes Carbon Mapper, the NGO, Planet, the commercial space company, NASA, the state of California, the University of Arizona, Arizona State University, and RMI. And in a minute, I'll talk about why we have that complex arrangement. What motivates us and what drives this program and why we felt compelled to do it, it really is on three different contexts. One is addressing what we perceive as an institutional and programmatic gap. It's about the challenges in deploying these systems because they're expensive. And let's be clear, right now, the governments aren't paying for all of this. They're paying for some of it. So part of our motivation was to address what I would call institutional and programmatic gaps. The second point is on the idea of completeness. Is if the ultimate goal is to provide data from satellites that supports mitigation efforts, then the real figure of merit is how much of the emissions can you see for a given application, whether it's an inventory or whether it's leak detection and repair or whether it's checking companies' commitments to meeting their decarbonization targets. the completeness, or what fraction of a total emissions you can see, fundamentally drives the architecture and design of the systems, how many satellites, what their field of view is, what their sensitivity is, etc. And the last point is data accessibility. And what I mean by that is the data transparent? Is it available where you need it, when you need it, in a format that can support decision making? One of the biggest things we've learned in our years of doing airborne surveys and providing this fine scale data to operators and regulators is there's often a gap. And those gaps can be fragmentation in jurisdiction, literally hundreds of actors. You may not know who to give the data to if they don't know to go looking for it. So there's a handoff challenge. And then there's often a technical capacity challenge on the other side. So I think a lot of what many of us are grappling with, whether it's analytics or other satellite programs or IMEO, is trying to go end to end, soup to nuts, to make the data not just available but understandable and actionable. So those are the three facets that guide our program. And it's more than just the satellites. It's a program around the satellites.
Really interesting. And how long has Carbon Mapper, the entity, been around?
Just about a year this month.
About a year this month. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. I thought that, but you know, time flies. There's just like COVID time in real time. So
the NGO itself is new, but the program we've been working on for over a decade, largely on the back of NASA's research program.
Right. Yeah. Makes sense. Stefan, we'd love to hear more about GHGSat.
Sure, thanks. So GHGSat is a commercial company that currently has three satellites in orbit. And we launched our first satellite in 2016. We launched two more in the last year. And we're offering commercial services now using those satellites to monitor facilities around the world. It's, as Steve said, it's a satellite that's really designed to look at high resolution. So seeing individual point sources, individual facilities, at the lowest possible detection threshold. So seeing the smallest possible emissions. And the purpose of that for us is to then take that data, combine it with actually aircraft data. We've taken the same sensor, put it on an aircraft, and combine it with third-party satellite data, so public satellite data sets, and then offer a commercial service to our customers. So customers who want to know what their own emissions are, and or governments that want to understand what the patterns of emissions are or where the large emitters are in their jurisdictions, or even third parties, analysts that are interested in understanding trends and changes in emissions around the world. So, and maybe that's a good segue into a second point I wanted to make that really is a bit different between all of us, is that really our entire mission is commercial. What we are doing is not about building satellites. It's not about advancing technology for the sake of filling holes. It's to serve an end customer need. And we designed our system from the beginning to serve that end customer need, which was about understanding the emissions that are happening today at industrial facilities around the world. You can't manage what you can't measure, right? So we are there, and it's as all of us are, working to do that. We're doing it really from a commercial point of view. So the last point I want to make is just to actually draw your attention to a snapshot that we put out just today. It's a new report that we put out today. It releases all of the emissions data we've collected over the last over five years now of flying our satellites. And it starts to show some pretty alarming trends. So we have seen, just in the last year, dramatic acceleration in emissions of oil and gas, methane from oil and gas, and dramatic acceleration in emissions from coal. But the patterns are very clear. And so for us, it's really about delivering that kind of data, bringing that kind of information to the service of the industries that emit them, being a trusted partner to them, but also being a trusted partner to governments and to any other party that wants to buy our data. Our goal is to provide that commercial service, to provide that data for anybody to use, and apply in whatever way they feel they need to in order to achieve, at the end of the day, a mitigation in greenhouse gas emissions, which is really our end objective, and I think a shared objective between all of us.
And that fine resolution is really an interesting characteristic, right? It's commercial data and fine resolution at facility level, right?
Correct.
And that's really clear, and I think a helpful differentiation.
It is, and maybe that's an important point, and again, in complementarity, to pick up a point that Steve was talking about earlier. You know, we are building something that is designed really to look at individual facilities, but not necessarily on regional scales or not necessarily on global scales. To do that, you need, in our case, many, many satellites. So we have three in orbit now. There's six more that are being built as we speak, and I'm about to order another three. So we're going to have a constellation of 10 out by the end of 2023. And so for us, having that 10 satellites enables daily coverage in key regions like the Permian Basin, for example, in the United States. So it's really having coverage either through a number of satellites or by having a satellite that's designed for coverage, revisit frequency by having a number of satellites that go back to the same place all the time, and then having that with high resolution and low detection threshold.
I'd love to hear more about Kairos first.
Yeah, so I'm not a satellite guy at the beginning, you know. I'm the bad guy, you know, I come from the energy industry. But 12 years ago, I created an NGO to look at the technology for the energy transition, and we identify the leaks of methane as being a big threat to the energy transition because it might challenge the role of gas as a transition fuel. We have no idea on how to solve it, but at least this was clearly identified. And what we do at Kairos is to provide to government, energy operators, and investors as much data as possible on the status of energy assets. So we look at production level, at inventories, and so we've mapped all the energy assets in the world, whether producing or consuming. So we have all the cement plants in the world, the power plants, oil wells, whatever you want to, which is linked to the energy system. And when Sentinel-5P came, we said, okay, we need to crack it. And as we have a scientist that was connected to Riley and to EDF, and so we've worked a lot on Sentinel-5P to really extract value from this satellite, but using the existing understanding of the energy system, because we track activity at the well level in real time. So we had a very good prior, as we say, we had a good understanding of the system, which means that we've been able to relate the abnormal concentration that we can see in a Sentinel-5-2 actual assets and make sense out of what we can see with Sentinel-5. And I remember at the beginning we saw there was, two or three ultra emitters a year. And when we cracked Sentinel, we found 1,000 a year. Last week there were 40 events above 10 tons per hour. 40. Yeah. So... And that was a shock, to see how much, all of that coming from coal, oil, and gas, because obviously that's what basically Sentinel-5P can see, that large concentration of... We need to keep on pushing for that, and obviously there is a commercial aspect with that, and we work with GSESTA to provide, a solution for the operator, for them to reduce. But there is also a public good aspect of that, and like all of us, we want to contribute our data to the EMEO so that... there is an understanding at government level, regulatory level, but also investors and the general public that we can see things, and everybody of us needs to act so that this practice, stops, because releasing methane during a pipeline maintenance makes no sense. I mean, that's absurd. So we are very happy to contribute to the EMEO, and I really want to thank Steve and the EDF, all the work they've been doing for the last 10 years to raise a flag and preach in the desert. The good thing is that now the desert is populated. So.
Now, you just mentioned EMEO. I understand they're trying to be a platform of platforms, essentially. Now, are all of you participating in EMEO, or most of you participating in EMEO? And just why don't you take a second and explain what that is, just in case... The average viewer doesn't know what EMEO is.
We need to leave, the chief,
Sure. So EMEO is the International Methane Emission Observatory, and the president of the European Commission described it in her talk about the Methane Pledge. The goal there is to bring all of these data together in a public platform and integrate them so that everyone can understand how they relate. Because we just heard they're different platforms. They'll see different aspects of the issue. And we don't have enough data with any of them to fully have full clarity. So the goal is, how do we bring the data together? Not just the remote sensing, which is a big piece, but also the direct measurement, the aircraft measurements that Riley talked about that he's been involved with. Also the oil and gas methane partnership 2.0, where more than 70 companies are providing voluntary data, as well as the inventories. How do we bring all that data together in a common platform that's totally open? So the UN Environment Program is leading this effort. It's a civil society effort, and it's great to have the kind of data, and Stefan can talk about the announcement he was part of yesterday related to that, of bringing these data together. As far as I know, no effort like this has ever occurred within the greenhouse gas world, where we're bringing these many different streams together involving data coming out of the European Union, coming out of NGO, coming out of a private sector, so that we can create a rapid response public database that tells us what's happening, where it's going, and ideally what we all want, we're all going to push for, how it's declining over time.
Do you want to add anything to that?
I can just talk about our contribution to the IMEO. So we announced yesterday that we will be contributing all of GHGSat's data to the IMEO. And so that's our archive, and over the next 4 years, and after that, we'll talk again. But the idea is that we want to contribute to the public good as well. So the IMEO provides a unique platform where we can both do that and also maintain the commercial value of our data. So we think we can do both. We've already done that once. We already have, for example, on our website, a free map of concentrations of the world. That's a combination of our data with other satellite data. And so for us, that's an important part of what we do. We are first and foremost a commercial business, but we understand that it's critical to contribute to the public good in this time when we're all trying to reduce methane emissions.
88.3 Southern FM.